Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning, and welcome to The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a long-running radio station finds renewed relevance, and a tiny pest is threatening Arizona livestock. Could it pose a threat to humans? But first, as the Trump administration continues to announce drastic measures to intensify its immigration crackdown, the president recently proposed the idea of reopening Alcatraz. Alcatraz is a long-shuttered prison complex on an island in San Francisco Bay. For decades, it's been a tourist destination where visitors can walk through some of the most primitive and harsh facilities in the history of American law enforcement. But one thing even Arizona tourists might not realize is that Alcatraz has a unique connection to our state. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio recently reported on this, and he joins me now. Gabe, good morning.
Morning, Sam.
So one of the things you talked about in your piece is what Alcatraz represents culturally. And there's a way that we think about the place in pop culture. There seems to be a way that President Trump thinks about it. Tell us about that.
For sure. I think President Trump doesn't deny the cinema impacts and culture Hollywood and the silver screen had for Alcatraz in amplifying this message. And the message that he articulated is this idea of law and order, that this is a symbol of a place essentially where people who committed crimes who should be punished by the state go effectively. And that was part of the rhetoric that was expressed in the Oval Office essentially when he announced last month in May this idea of floating the idea at least of reopening Alcatraz. Since then, in the weeks following the announcement, top leaders from the Bureau of Prisons, federal prisons went and they did site assessments at Alcatraz. They even toured the facility to see how feasible that is. There's still no update or progress on where they stand. The feds do at this point about reopening it, but
yeah,
there's progress there.
That was a very interesting thing I learned from your piece, that this wasn't just pure rhetoric from President Trump. He actually sent people to tour and do an assessment of the site. And as you were mentioning, you know, Machine Gun Kelly was imprisoned there. This is a place that has long sort of held this place in the American consciousness of, like, this is where we send the baddest dudes. But one of the things you're reporting on in your piece is the specific connection to Arizona and the Hopi tribe specifically of Alcatraz. Tell us about that.
For sure. Members of the Hopi tribe, some refer to them as the Hopi 19, were arrested in 1894, a couple of years after what the U.S. Army refers to as its Indian Wars, which was essentially this violent campaign that lasted over a century, the conflict of trying to settle the West in the eyes of the U.S. federal government from indigenous peoples. And part of that, the reason why they were arrested was in response to what they charged up as seditious acts in the form of refusing to let their children attend Indian boarding schools, which sought to forcibly assimilate them into mainstream culture, cutting their hair, teaching them English, getting rid of their native language, and taking them away from their communities. A couple of years prior to when they were arrested in 1890, about 104 children were taken from one of those communities in Third Mesa. They were sent to the Keams Canyon boarding school. And when the U.S. Army returned in 1894, they arrested the Hopi 19. They were considered all leaders from the Pueblo village of Oribe in northern Arizona. And so that was the situation there. And eventually they were charged in 1895 with confinement and hard labor for the seditious act charges. And they were sent to Alcatraz by the then Commissioner of Indian Affairs, Daniel Monroe Browning, because he wanted to move them as far away from the scene of the crime, essentially, or the problem, because there was a lot of conflict brewing up in the mesas as a result of resistance to the boarding school agenda by the U.S. government at that time.
Yeah. I mean, just, you know, in the conversation about symbolism and what this place represents, I'm really glad you made that point, because it is remarkable how far away from their home these folks were sent, not just thousands of miles, but literally to an island, you know, out in the ocean, incredibly removed from Arizona. One of the folks that you spoke to in your piece is a U of A professor who talks about how Alcatraz has historically been, quote, a place to put problematic people. And it seemed like in the conversations that you had for this, the sort of like gauzy cinematic way that Alcatraz often gets talked about outside of Native communities, it's very different within the Hopi community, right?
I think that's a fair assessment. You know, a place to put problematic people in the eyes of federal government, whether that was, you know, uncommon criminals or in this case, you know, indigenous peoples resisting their federal agenda to assimilate them through boarding schools that were designed to essentially erase their identity, language, and culture. And so, you know, as we're seeing now, and there's resonance with this story today as much as it was in 1894, that essentially, you know, this challenge of understanding what is Alcatraz, what does it mean, is it very different depending on who you talk to. And it is a symbol in that respect.
Yeah. Interestingly, though, as you also report, there was an effort on the part of some in the Native community in the middle of last century to reclaim Alcatraz, right?
That's right. And there was a 19-month occupation of Alcatraz. It is known as Occupy the Rock movement. It, you know, took place from 1969 to 1971. And that was really a breaking point, some saw, that the federal government at that time was not honoring the trust and treaty responsibilities to the tribes across Indian country. And as a result, former Interior Secretary Deb Haaland called that moment an act of desperation on behalf of indigenous peoples to get recognition and respect from the U.S. government by taking over this then at that time since shut down prison, which was closed in 1963, so about 6 years after that. And then a year after, when the U.S. government reclaimed the island in 1971, the land actually went to the Interior Department, to the National Park Service, which is, as you mentioned earlier, where tourists go today to learn about all this history.
Well, a very different storyline about Alcatraz from KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio. Gabe, thank you so much.
Thanks, Sam.
In the wake of the Trump administration's crackdown on undocumented immigrants in the U.S., a Spanish language radio network is using the airwaves to try to help their listeners know what to do if they come into contact with immigration authorities. Radio Campesina has been on the air for decades, but in recent months, some of its programming has taken on a new urgency. Annie Rosenthal has written about this. She's a reporter covering rural communities and the U.S., Mexico borderlands for High Country News. She spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, who asked what changes this network has been making over the past several months.
Yeah, that's a great question. So Radio Campesina is a network that was founded by Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers in the 80s. And so I think sort of civil rights programming geared towards workers has been part of their approach for a long time, because they've always done sort of both music and more kind of informational like news you can use programming too. And they got a lot of attention before the presidential election when they were doing a lot of disinformation programming, helping people figure out what was real and what was not. What has changed is since the election, pretty soon after the election, they started a new weekly program called Conoce Tus Derechos, or Know Your Rights. And the point of that is basically to bring on community organizers or lawyers who can help answer listener questions about your rights under a variety of situations, but often about immigration and sort of responding to the Trump administration's increased, you know, ICE deportations.
It seems as though, based on reading your story, that immigration and immigration-related fears within the Hispanic community have really seemed to take a front and center place with this network's programming.
Yeah, I think, I mean, just talking to the host there that I spoke with, they have definitely been hearing a lot from listeners in Phoenix, around Arizona, and then also they reach listeners in Nevada and California and a few other states as well, that's really top of mind for a lot of people. And also that they're hearing a lot of disinformation, that people are getting rumors of raids that are not happening, and they're not sure what their rights are, what they're able to do to prepare themselves or their families, their community members. And so talking to folks at the station, a lot of what I heard was that they see their role as helping people know their rights, and then also just sort of cut through the chaos and say, you know, this is what's really happening. This is what's not allow fear to kind of take over people's lives.
Has Radio Campesina been getting any pushback or blowback for taking this approach?
Not as far as I've heard. When I spoke to them in February, they said what they were doing was really consistent with what they've been doing for decades as a radio station, that it's all legal. It's about helping people understand their rights. But I know that other radio stations in the West have seen, as the Trump administration is taking this really aggressive approach to trying to suppress some immigration reporting. And in earlier this year, the FCC announced it was going to open an investigation into a San Francisco radio station for doing live coverage of ICE raids. And a lot of First Amendment experts say that kind of coverage is covered under the First Amendment, that it is a, you know, matter of public interest, law enforcement stuff. But we're seeing that from the Trump administration more broadly, of course, with cracking down on PBS, on NPR, and trying to basically suppress coverage that they don't like. I do know that Radio Campesina and other of the smaller Spanish language radio stations I spoke with, they're being very careful to follow FCC regulations around what you are allowed to do on the radio to make sure that resource remains accessible for their community members.
Sure. Well, what role do networks like Radio Campesina and others play in the Hispanic community?
I mean, I think they play a bunch of roles. So there's a really long and fascinating history, I think, of Spanish language radio as a tool for protecting immigrant communities and also for providing education and comfort. Spanish language radio in the US really took off after the advent of public broadcasting in the 70s and 80s, and that was often in these rural farm worker communities in places like Northern California and Washington, where radio was a really uniquely effective medium for reaching farm workers. You could bring a little transistor radio with you to the fields and listen to corridos and music that would remind you of home if you had moved from somewhere far away. And also the sort of anonymity of the radio allowed people to bring questions about navigating the immigration system, about healthcare, this kind of intimate space to help people navigate civic life. So I think Radio Campesina and also these smaller stations have this long history of being both a comfort community and then kind of urgent news provision and helping people protect themselves.
Does it seem as though Spanish language radio plays maybe a different role or occupies a different space than other Spanish language media in terms of like TV or the internet or anything else?
I think it's a little hard to draw distinctions at this point because I know like at Radio Campesina, they are, for example, putting a lot of their shows on social media now, and a lot of the, you know, what used to be just calls that they would get in to call in shows are often messages coming in on WhatsApp or Facebook, their voice memos. So I think it's harder to draw quite as clear of a distinction between what is, you know, digital media, TV, and radio. But I know that, I mean, radio, I think, holds a really special place for a lot of people. In part because it harkens back to this older time and it's this place for entertainment, but also the sort of ephemerality of radio used to provide a really helpful tool sometimes. There's some really fascinating history of these smaller stations I was mentioning using radio, for example, as a way to warn people about raids, like with using a special song that would be a code for people to say like, okay, there's, you know, immigration activity. So things like that where it happened quickly, it was harder to trace. That's not something that those stations are doing now because that they're, you know, very cautious about what's legal, but thinking about the sort of power of radio as a technology there, I think is really interesting.
So when you spoke with hosts and executives and other folks with Radio Campesina, what did they say about what they think is coming down the pike for them and what their role might be or shift to over the next several months and maybe into the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to talk to the folks at Radio Campesina because I think they have been getting a lot of requests from media, you know, like me, saying like, hey, there's all this crazy stuff going on right now. You know, what does this mean for you? And part of their message was this has been our role for a long time. You know, in Phoenix, we were, you know, here during the era of Joe Arpaio. We were here, you know, further back than that, and the, seeing the ways that immigrant communities in Arizona and throughout the West have experienced turmoil in many different eras, they were saying, you know, we have been in this fight for a long time, and part of our role is to help people navigate with a clear head and, you know what information is real and know that there's light at the end of the tunnel and that whoever you are, you have rights and that this resource is here to help you.
All right. That is Annie Rosenthal with High Country News. Annie, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, a parasitic fly may be making a comeback in livestock.
Livestock economists are predicting if it got into the United States like we once had it in the 50s, 60s, that it would be cost $150 billion.
What the spread of screwworm would mean for Americans. But first, we continue now with our series of conversations about masculinity and its torments. And I'm excited to introduce you all to somebody who, for me, is one of my most trusted voices on this subject. His name is Mark Pagan, and he is the creator and host of the podcast Other Men Need Help. Mark describes the show as an investigation of the, quote, emblems, habits, and struts of the male performance. Here's a clip from the show.
It was a Saturday night. Everybody was out. I noticed this couple that's at the corner nearby me. It's a man and a woman. They're in their early 30s. And he's standing on the curb hailing a cab, but he's doing it in this cool guy way. And what I mean by that is he's not making eye contact with the direction traffic is coming from, and he's got one thumb in his waistband, and his cab arm is like a dying plant. It's not eye-catching. I don't know if he thinks this is effective or if he just wants to look cool. Now I look over at who I assumed was his girlfriend, and I could tell that she was just done with the night. Her arms were crossed, her feet were tapping. She took his impotent, dying plant arm and dragged it down, and she threw her arm up, locked her eyes in the road, and within 15 seconds, a cab came to the curb. It was like a PSA for effective cab gettage. And before they got in the cab, the guy did this head twist thing, looking around like, did anybody see that? And I sat there going, I totally did.
That is Mark Pagan, the host of Other Men Need Help. And Mark joins me now. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. That's wild to hear that. That's from the first episode in 2017. I haven't listened to that in, I don't know, 8 years.
Yes, a very deep cut. Well, the reason that I wanted to kind of feature that moment is because I think it does so many things that help illustrate what I love so much about your show, which is not just the fact that it keenly observes the odd dynamics in what you call the male performance, but it also acknowledges the fact that this is your own perspective. You include yourself in the attempt to figure out what in the world the male performance is. And to start, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, in addition to that moment with that couple, where does that come from for you personally? What got you interested in this idea?
Well, I'll try to make it brief, but it really, I grew up with a lot of women in the house, and I think I just was socialized towards things that the women in the house were really interested in. And I didn't fully associate with, like, I wasn't a sporty kid or anything like that. And then adding to that, my dad died when I was 14, and my mom was faced with raising a boy into a man. She gave me two things. She gave me my father's razor and a subscription to Esquire magazine, sort of like figure it out. And so I spent my life, and this started even before my father passed away, but I spent my life really kind of like my head pressed against the glass, looking at how masculinity works. How can I be masculine? What does it mean? And by the time I got into my 30s, I had this, this revelation. I had a really, like, almost like a gut punch of, I've been lied to. I am not hearing anybody talk about the experiences that are going on in my head.
Yeah.
And I know other men, other people are going through this. And so I, as somebody who grew up on men's media and sort of like masculinity in media, I thought, what would it look like if I did this and made a project in which it was using sort of like the structure or the tools of like a men's magazine or a show about men, and being completely transparent, like people going, I can't believe you shared that.
Yes.
Not in a way of being shocking, but in a way of going like, am I the only one here?
Right, right.
So, yeah.
Well, that makes me think about just a couple of examples from the show that I think illustrate that really nicely. You did an episode once about feeling insecure around men who are taller than you. You did an episode about the fact that your girlfriend, now your wife, at the time was making more money than you did. And one particularly memorable one about whether or not to use like exclamation points in terms of affection in emails to male friends. I mean, these, to my ear at least, were the parts of masculinity that, as you said, are extremely active concerns, but that aren't talked about very much. You started this in 2017, and I'm curious, you know, what was it like to have these ideas received then, and how has that evolved through to 2025?
Well, it's really interesting, the timing, because this came out in September 2017, and we had a nice response to it. But a lot of people started saying, wow, you really, you know, you're responding to this current administration and the Me Too movement. I really wasn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is just, you know, there was a long, as with any project, there was a long on-ramp to getting it out there. But, you know, it was coming in at that time. And so I think there was maybe in fall of 2017 on a certain demographic of people were interested in hearing this very transparent sort of like ownership side of masculinity.
Yeah.
And what I've seen change a little bit since 2017, and this is anecdotal, but I'm seeing at least more men understanding conditions that are making them feel lonely or depressed or disconnected, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. It's up to an individual to make the changes in their life. The things that, you know, this project, which is now 8 years old and we're talking in 2025, the thing that still alarms me is the discourse is maybe even worse around masculinity. Hmm. It's I think commonly like very antagonistic. You know, like a term like toxic masculinity has been used ad nauseum to a point where it means nothing. And in some ways, people are now embracing it.
Right. They're
saying, you're gonna call me that, I'm gonna be that. Going back to 2017, our plan was like, I think the problem that I was finding in media too, and which we're getting even more of now, is that none of this was talking about the day-to-day experiences. It was all think pieces about public figures and big picture work. And it's so easy for us to look at somebody and say, well, I'm not going to be Harvey Weinstein. I will never have that kind of power. So the microaggressions in my life, I don't have to examine. And I think that's even getting even more, it's getting even worse. It's not focusing on the introspective or the day-to-day masculinity of our lives.
Yeah.
And lastly, it's optimization and self-improvement are the ways to be a man. And that I think has become even more announced over the last 8 years.
Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit more about this, because I know this is something you've been thinking about more recently. You mentioned this idea of toxic masculinity, which is a way that folks on the more progressive side of things often frame the conversation. And You've said that toxic masculinity is a phrase that you purposely do not use in other men. Why is that?
Correct. Well, I think number one, it's become asinine. Mm-hmm. It is a go-to phrase. I have a Google Alerts for a number of phrases, masculinity being one of them. Mm-hmm. Just seeing how is it being used in just the general discourse. And the majority of Google Alerts related to masculinity include the word toxic. And it is associated with everything. My child is not brushing his teeth every night. He's on a path to being a toxic male, you know, all these things. And it's like, what does this even mean anymore? And yeah. I think that the main thing too is that if you're approaching a group of people, if you are approaching them, regardless of what their position in the world has been, but in particular, if you're approaching men who have traditionally, we have been in power, and you are immediately attacking them, I don't care who you are, it is not going to land. So if what is the intention of using toxic masculinity? What is if the intention is inviting in, then I think the initial ways in which we're using that language should not put people up in a defensive stance.
Yeah.
I don't disagree with sort of like the general discourse of the way that we are raised as boys and
right.
things that right. happen in our lives that make us, you know, make us got to work and make us have to make changes as we get older. But I think that the way of approaching it is completely wrong by using that as the go-to phrase.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I'm curious, as you look at the other side of the coin, the sort of more what is often referred to as the manosphere side of the conversation, mm-hmm. I know that one of the phrases you have sort of raised your eyebrow at is this idea of high value men mm-hmm. versus high value women. Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think one of the things moving through 8 years of this show that I've come to realize about myself are the ways that competition have destroyed my life in a lot of ways, the ways that it made me disconnected. And I'm not just talking about capitalistically and, you know, the kind of the culture that we live in, but the ways in which I have been taught you need to withhold certain standards to fit into a male group. Otherwise, you need to think in terms of this alpha, hustle, dominance, grit, discipline, warrior, mm-hmm. all of these phrases that are sort of antagonistic. And I feel like, number one, they're antagonistic. I think a lot of the language that we use for our boys and for us men, when we're looking at articles or listening to podcasts, creates this antagonistic energy. The other thing, and probably more important thing to start off with, is they're solitary. Mm. None of it is about connection. None of it is saying, you're having a hard time at work, you're feeling jealous over your partner's ex, whatever it is, who can you talk to about this? Right. How can you connect with your partner about it? What are the ways in which there's a community that can help you? It is all about, you have to be the one that dominates this dude, you know, all of this stuff. I do love using that voice. So while this discourse continues, I will use that voice.
Yeah.
But it's a real shame, and it puts us in these solitary competitive, and we it creates a lens on the way we interact with everybody, regardless of gender.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is Mark Pagan. You can find Other Men Need Help wherever you get your podcasts and also on Substack. Mark, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Well, if masculinity is in crisis, there is no shortage of opinion for how to address that crisis. These are issues that Frederick Rabinowitz has been tracking for a long time. Rabinowitz is a therapist and the author of 5 books on the subject. They have titles like Man Alive, A Primer of Men's Issues, and Breaking Barriers in Counseling Men. Among other things, since the 1980s, Rabinowitz has been convening weekly discussion groups for men, encouraging them to talk openly with each other about how they navigate things like fatherhood, friendship, and the pressure to be seen as leaders. I spoke with Rabinowitz recently, and he told me his work isn't just about encouraging men to think about themselves differently, it's about saving their lives.
Men lead the statistics on everything from, you know, obesity to suicide. Okay, there's a lot of things we don't do very well. And I think a lot of it comes from not having outlets. And so we eat too much, we gamble too much, watch too much porn on the internet. You know, there's too many things that can distract us from actually dealing with our inner selves. And I know that, you know, when guys come to like the men's group, it's a relief. They feel relieved to be able to be in a place where it's safe to talk about what's really going on in their lives.
And could you give us some examples of the kinds of things that you find men really want to talk about that they are covering up with those other behaviors you were just alluding
to? Yeah, I would say there's a lot of guys have a lot of stress. They're worried about their performance, whether it's at work or whether it's, you know, in terms of activities they're doing. And they work really hard, a lot of them behind the scenes. And they don't really have anyone to sort of debrief or process all that stuff with. The other thing I know that's happening is there's a lot of relationship issues. Mm-hmm. Guys who are in relationships, I know, relationships are hard. And so to only have your partner to bounce stuff off of can actually turn out to be kind of a distortion mirror. Because if you're in a relationship where the dynamics are such where you feel bad or you feel ashamed or you feel angry, it's really hard to kind of get an outside perspective on that.
Yeah. I mean, you're making me think that in some ways I feel like, you know, the scariest thing to say out loud for a lot of men is, hey guys, I don't know what I'm doing.
Yes. Yeah.
Like I'm not prepared for this situation that I'm being called to navigate.
Right. We're supposed to know what's going on. We're supposed to be in charge. You know, there's so many factors that are outside of our control. The other thing I think is important is that knowing yourself is really important in terms of what you bring out to the world. And so having a relationship with various aspects of who you are, who am I under stress? Who am I when I'm relaxed? What do I like to do? How do I feel about myself? How do I feel about my past history? Having a good relationship with myself actually allows me to then choose to see what parts of myself I can reveal to other people.
I want to ask you how you encourage men to open up at these men's groups that you've been running for almost 40 years at this point. But I'm also inclined to ask, how do you encourage somebody to even come to one of those events? Because once they get there, I'm imagining that there's at least some, you know, benevolent peer pressure to open up and talk about these things. But I can imagine you must encounter a lot of resistance in even convincing somebody to show up at one.
I think a guy oftentimes has to be in a place where he's really feeling the consequences of his own loneliness, or he's feeling the consequences of keeping things inside. That could be depression, anxiety. Some of them are abusing drugs. Some of them are engaging in activities like with prostitutes or something. Like they know something's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And so the group can sound pretty good.
Yeah. We're sort of dancing around a provocative idea that there is potentially a correlation between a lot of things that we sometimes see as traditionally like masculine, manly behaviors, like drinking a lot, visiting sex workers, doing certain kinds of drugs, like extreme behaviors, things you've alluded to already in this conversation, and loneliness.
I would say there's a high correlation there.
Yeah.
A person is trying in whatever way they know how to either avoid that feeling of loneliness and sadness and depression, or they're at some level not wanting to kind of really grasp with what is really going on with me.
But obviously it would be better if people didn't have to reach that point of extremity and danger to recognize the value of this.
I agree. And, you know, and I think things are changing. You know, I have a wait list for my men's group. It's not like, I have guys that want to be in there that I don't have room for. You know, like the way I promote my practice is that it's geared towards guys. Uh-huh. And so I try to use stories and metaphors that are more oriented towards how men talk.
Can you give me an example of that? Like what would an example of one of those?
Well, you know, like when someone comes in, I go, so what's our game plan? You know, something like that. simple as that.
Right.
And all of a sudden they're like, yeah, I understand that. That's like, that's common in sports. That's common right. in business.
Right.
You know? And so I talk that language, like, how are we going to do this? I'm also a poker player. So I oftentimes use poker metaphors. It sounds like you went all in with that one.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, I did. Those kinds of things make it feel like, oh, this is normal to talk about myself. And here are some words that I already know how to use. I've worked with people that are on like sports teams and stuff like that. Those guys tend to have pretty close relationships with each other, ironically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you would think that those are kind of traditional masculinity. But what happens is when you're in close contact with people and you're trying to perform together or trying to do activities, you need to talk.
What do you make of the impact, or do you think there has been an impact of the most recent presidential election on this whole conversation? Because one of the things that was really striking to me in covering some of the more conservative political rallies last fall was this phenomenon of American masculinity being explicitly discussed. And the idea that we need a return to a much more conservative, traditional form of that masculinity because, in the framing of these particular activists, our relationship to gender has gotten all out of whack, I suppose, in their minds.
There are aspects, this is like on both political sides, that I think need to be integrated. You know, so on one hand, I think that if you're talking from the left, you know, where the feminists, you know, really helped out women in terms of becoming more equal partners, being in the workplace, being assertive, being strong. It feels like, I don't think they meant to do this, the culture did kind of say, guys, you're the problem. And so we didn't come up with a lot of solutions if we're the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where I work, you know, is like, hey, there are skills, there are ways that we can become more self-aware, become more flexible, become more strong in how we present ourselves to the world, and also have a heart, be empathic, be understanding. You know, they're not mutually exclusive. We're nuanced, we're complex beings.
Well, Dr. Frederick E. Rabinowitz is a psychologist and a professor at the University of Redlands, the author of many books on this subject. And thank you, Fred, for talking about this really slippery and fascinating subject.
Thanks, Sam.
Good morning and welcome back once again to the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman. Avian flu continues to affect egg and poultry producers in Maricopa County and elsewhere. Hickman's Family Farms says it's lost nearly all of its birds to the disease, but it's not the only potential threat to Arizona livestock. The U.S. Department of Agriculture last month stopped the movement of cows, horses, and bison between Mexico and the U.S. because of a parasitic fly that lays hundreds of eggs in the animals. The New World screwworm can affect any warm-blooded animals, including humans, and it's got our next guest concerned. Bass Aja is Executive Vice President of the Arizona Cattle Feeders Association. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody, and they started with the fact that once the eggs hatch, the worms themselves just kind of start eating away at the flesh of the host.
The screwworm actually has two, like, tentacle knives, claws on its mouth, and it twists and eats its way in, which is why they call it the screwworm.
Yeah. Does it kill the cow?
It can. It can. Undetected, untreated, it will kill the animal.
So what kind of treatment options do you have?
Usually you have to physically handle the animal, you know, rope them or catch them. And then you put a topical treatment on that's a parasitic killer. And there's various names for them all. And one of them is like a pine tar oil thing, they call it. And that's what you use to treat it.
So this is not the first time that this has been an issue, right? I mean, the screwworm has not been a concern for many, many years. But am I right that in your younger days, this was something that you had to deal with on a not infrequent basis?
Yes, my family's been raising sheep and cattle in Arizona for over 100 years. And in the 60s, we were treating hundreds of sheep and cattle for screwworm.
And like, how easy or difficult was it to do?
It's not like it's difficult to treat. It's difficult to detect. And with the screwworm, you'll smell it before you see it. And that means that it's already kind of gotten in the host a little bit. And so then, you know, it takes one or two or three treatments to save the animal.
I would imagine that smell is not terribly pleasant.
It's the one of the worst smells I've ever smelled in my life.
And how big are the worms?
The worms are about 3/8 to a half inch.
Pretty
long.
Small.
Yeah, they're small.
So how big of a concern is it to you and to your members that we could be seeing this again in American cows?
Livestock economists are predicting if it got into the United States like we once had it in the 50s, 60s, that it would cost $150 billion.
Wow. And given that cattle is a pretty big component of Arizona's economy, obviously there's still a lot of ranchers here, it seems like a pretty big deal for Arizona too.
Well, it is a big deal. Arizona's nearly $4 billion cattle industry would it would hurt dramatically. And also, other countries, if you have an outbreak, there's some trade barriers once you're found to have screwworm, which is right now we have the border closed with Mexico because of screwworm.
Right. So that would mean that, for example, if there were screwworm in Arizona cattle, ranchers would not be able to sell the beef to other countries?
We might not be able to move our cattle to other states. And also other countries might forbid us from selling beef there.
How did it come to be that this is a thing that you have to worry about again?
Well, we walled off the screwworm at the Darien Gap in Central America in the early 70s and then continued a program of releasing sterile flies. And so I think people kind of got complacent. Different countries, not just the U.S., but a lot of countries quit putting as many resources into it. And then as the people in those countries were finding it difficult to live, that one of the ways they found they could live, they could start raising cattle. And so they started raising cattle in areas in Central America where they hadn't previously. Mm. And so it left a host for the fly and the worm to move up the isthmus.
Is closing the border with Mexico, at least as far as cattle is concerned, is that enough in your mind to stop the threat?
Oh, no. No. They're releasing sterile flies 7 days a week now. There's some hiccups. There's some problems with getting the flights out of Panama, where the sterile facility is, into Mexico. Some bureaucratic stuff, and we need to release. Well, what they say to really control it, we're going to need to release 50 to 100 million flies a day, and we're doing about 100 to 150 a week. So it's not enough. Our fly facilities were shut down or converted to fruit fly facilities because of the danger of the fruit fly for citrus. And so we're trying to retool some of those back up.
And the idea with the sterile flies is that the screwworms try to reproduce with them and they're not able to, and then the population just goes down.
Yes. The target is the male, sterilize the male, and then there's no reproduction.
So let's assume that you could get the quantity of flies to release that you say we need to. Is that enough, or are there other measures you need to take as well?
Well, that's the main one, to control it in the narrowest part of Mexico, what they call the isthmus. And we have a line there now, and there's only been one or two detections above it. But you need to have about 50 million flies per square mile to really have effective control. And so if you get a real narrow area, you can do a lot of flies per square mile. If it starts getting farther north into Mexico, it takes more and more and more flies. Plus, it gets closer to Texas. That isthmus is only about 700 miles from Texas today.
Has screwworm been detected north of there so far?
Two incidents. And they're not active now, but they were and they caught them.
In the universe of things that keep you up at night, where does this one rank?
This one ranks up there, and especially as it goes forward. I wasn't really worried about screwworm. I heard about it in, you know, Panama and then in Costa Rica. But when it hit Guatemala, it got our attention. And then when it got into Mexico, it was, you know, it was no holds barred now.
Are your members testing? Are they trying to be on the lookout for signs of it?
They're always looking. We have bioplans for our ranches and feedlots and dairies and that. So we're always watching for stuff. And as you can see, what is happening with HPAI, they're always on the lookout.
Do you see any parallels between this situation and what we've been seeing with avian flu in terms of how chicken producers are having to deal with that and whole flocks having to be wiped out and that kind of thing?
Yes and no, but mostly no, because HPAI is viral, right? With the screwworm, it's not that way. The short lifespan of the fly, and it's not viral. It takes that physical contact and laying of the egg. But it is something that makes us look at our food production system is very important to protect.
All right. That is Bass Aha, Executive Vice President of the Arizona Cattle Feeders Association. Bass, thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Well, you know, here at the show, we think of all of you listening right now as fellow nuanced, complex beings, and we hope that today's show has made you feel a little more self-aware, helped you become a little bit more flexible, and maybe a little bit more prepared to navigate the universe of things that keep you up at night. We hope you will join us again tomorrow morning, right back here at 9 a.m. For Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger, I'm Sam Dingman. Talk to you then.